groupings. But that half-Indian world, that world removed in time and space from India, and mysterious to the man, its language not even half understood, its religion and religious rites not grasped, that half-Indian world was the social world the man knew. It was all that he had outside school and the life of the imagination fed by books and the cinema. That village world had given him its prejudices and passions. He was interested in, had been passionate about, the politics of India before and after independence. Yet he knew little about his community in Trinidad. He thought that because he belonged to it, he understood it. He thought that the life of the community was like an extension of the life of his family, and he knew nothing of other communities. He had only the prejudices of his time in that colonial, racially mixed setting. He was profoundly ignorant. He hadn't been to a restaurant, hated the idea of eating food from foreign hands, yet at the same time he had dreamed of fulfillment in a foreign country. He looked for adventure. On this first day he found it, but he also came face to face with his ignorance. This ignorance undermined, mocked the writer, or the ambition of the writer, made nonsense of the personality the writer wished to assume, elegant, knowing, unsurprised, like Somerset Maugham. Or, a truer comparison, like the Trinidad Negro with a tight borrowed jacket in the hangar, or shed at Puerto Rico, on his way to Harlem, and quite another idea of glamour. So my memories of my arrival late at night in New York are vague. I think back hard now, and certain details become clearer. A very bright building, dazzling lights, a little crowd in a small space, a woman official with a very sharp American accent calling out the names of certain passengers. There was a letter for me. A man from the British consulate should have met me, but the plane had been so delayed he had gone home, leaving this letter, which gave me only the name of the hotel he had booked me into. He should have protected me. He left me at the mercy of the taxi driver who took me into the city. The driver cheated me, charged too much, and then, seeing how easily I acquiesced, he stripped me of the few remaining dollars I had on me. I had a few more, very few, hidden in my suitcase, by claiming them as a tip. I felt this humiliation so keenly that memory blurred it soon, and then eradicated it for many years. I preferred to remember the taxi driver as being talkative, because that was the way taxi drivers were. I worked hard at remembering what he had said. "We sold the Japs all our scrap metal, and they shot it right back at us." And I remember the Negro, he must have occurred in the hotel, who talked like a Negro in a book or film. "Dis city never sleeps," or "Dis city sure don't sleep, man," and whom I couldn't tip because I had no money on me. The talkative taxi driver, the quaintly spoken Negro, I cherished them because I felt I knew them, because I felt they were confirming so much of what I had read, were confirming so much of my advance information. They reassured me that I was indeed travelling, and was already in New York, and in their familiar aspect they were material suitable for the writer. But the humiliation connected with each— the driver's theft, my inability to tip the Negro who was expecting me to play a character role too and give him a tip, got in the way, and they were edited out of my memory for 20 years. They were certainly edited out of the diary which I wrote with indelible pencil, already a little blunt, that evening in the hotel, on the hotel paper, for the extra drama. A family farewell in the morning, thousands of miles away. A farewell to my past, my colonial past and peasant Asiatic past. Immediately, then, the exaltation, the glimpse of the fields and the mountains which I had never seen, the rippled or wrinkled sea crawling, then the clouds from above, and thoughts of the beginning of the world, thoughts of time without beginning or end, the intense experience of beauty. A faint panic, then, even an acted panic, then a dwindling of the sense of the self. A suppressed, half-true, but also half-intensely true diary being written in a small, dark room of the Hotel Wellington in New York. And already a feeling of being lost, of truth not fully faced, of a world whose great size I had seized being made at night very small for me again. I had come to New York with some bananas. I had eaten some on the plane and left the others behind, guiltily but correctly. They would almost certainly have been taken from me by the authorities. I had also been given a roasted chicken, or half a roasted chicken. My family's peasant, Indian, Hindu fear about my food, about pollution, and this was an attempt to stay it, if only for that day. But I had no knife, no fork, no plate, and didn't know that these things might have been got from the hotel. Wouldn't have known how to set about asking, especially at that very late hour. I ate over the wastepaper basket, aware as I did so of the smell, the oil, the excess at the end of a long day. In my diary I had written of the biggest things, the things that befitted a writer, but the writer of the diary was ending his day like a peasant, like a man reverting to his origins, eating secretively in a dark room and then wondering how to hide the high-smelling evidence of his meal. I dumped it all in the wastepaper basket. After this I needed a bath, or a shower. The shower was in my own room, a luxury. I had dreaded having to use a communal one. One tap was marked hot. Such a refinement I had never seen before. In Trinidad, in our great heat, we had always bathed or showered in water of normal temperature, the water of the tap. A hot shower. I was expecting something tepid, like the warm bath water, in buckets, that my mother prepared for me, mixed with aromatic and medicinal neem leaves, on certain important days. The hot water of the Hotel Wellington shower wasn't like that. Hot was hot. Barely avoiding a scalding, I ducked out of the shower cubicle. So the great day ended. And then, it was my special gift and remained so for nearly 20 years, helping me through many crises, I fell asleep as soon as I got into bed and didn't wake up again until I had slept out all my sleep. My memory retains nothing of the hotel room in daylight, nothing of the room in which I awakened. Perhaps, then, some embarrassment obliterated the memory. Less than 24 hours out of my own place, the humiliations had begun to bank up. To my own developed sense of self was now added another sense of the self, a rawness of nerves and sensibility against which, from now on, for many years, all my impressions, even the most exalted, were to be set. As were the impressions of the morning, the ones that remained with me, impressions that, after the humiliations of the previous evening, the humiliations of arrival, resumed the romance. The newsstand downstairs, in the lobby of the Wellington, was part of this romance. A little shop, in the building where one lived. It was quite new to me, quite enchanting. I bought a packet of cigarettes from the man who was selling, a tall, grey-haired man, as well-dressed and formal and educated, I thought, as a teacher. Not like the Indian shopkeepers of our country villages, men who kept themselves deliberately dirty and ragged, the dirtier the better, to avoid hubris, to deter jealousy and the evil eye. Not like the Chinese in their parlours, who wore sleeveless vests and khaki shorts and wooden clogs, stayed indoors all the time, and in spite of their wizened, famine-stricken, opium-den appearance, fathered child after child on happy black concubines or blank-faced, flat-chested Chinese wives. From the tall, grey-haired man I bought a packet of Old Golds. I had no palate in tobacco, couldn't tell the difference between brands, and went mainly by things like names. In Trinidad, only locally made or English cigarettes were sold in the shops. American cigarettes were available, informally and in quantity, because of the American bases, but they were never sold in the shops. And this ability to buy a packet of American cigarettes, from the whole range of American names, was wonderful. As was the price, 15 cents, and the book of matches that came with it, largesse. The sensuousness of those soft American cigarette packets, the cellophane, the name of the brand, the paper of the packet outlining the shapes of the cigarettes, the thin red paper ribbon at the top of the packet which enabled you to undo the cellophane, the delicious smell. Cigarettes had always been for me an aesthetic experience. The flavour of burning tobacco I had never cared for, so the smoking addiction when it came had been severe. And if I had stopped smoking many times already at home, it was because I had for many months during the past worrying year been denying myself things, at one stage even secretly denying myself food, out of a wish not to lose my scholarship. The scholarship that was to take me to England and Oxford, which was not a wish so much to go to Oxford as a wish to get out of Trinidad and see the great world and make myself a writer. Such passion, such longing had gone into this journey, which was less than a day old. From the teacher-like grey-haired man at the newsstand I also bought a copy of the New York Times, the previous day's issue of which I had seen the previous day at Puerto Rico. I was interested in newspapers and knew this paper to be one of the foremost in the world, but to read a newspaper for the first time is like coming into a film that has been on for an hour. Newspapers are like serials. To understand them, you have to take knowledge to them. The knowledge that serves best is the knowledge provided by the newspaper itself. It made me feel a stranger, that paper. But on the front page, at the bottom, there was a story to which I could respond, because it dealt with an experience I was sharing. The story was about the weather. Apparently it was unseasonably cool and grey for the end of July. So unseasonable that it was worth a story. Without the paper, I would not have known that the weather was unseasonable. But I did not need the paper to make me see the enchantment of the light. The light indoors in the hotel was like the light outdoors. The outdoor light was magical. I thought it was created by the tall buildings, which, with some shame, I stopped to look up at, to get their size. Light indoors flowed into light outdoors. The light here was one. In Trinidad, from 7 or 8 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon, the heat was great. To be out of doors was to be stung, to feel the heat and discomfort. This grey sky and grey light, light without glare, suggested a canopied, protected world. No need going outside to brace oneself for heat and dazzle, and the city of protected-feeling streets and tall buildings was curiously softly coloured. I hadn't expected that, hadn't seen that in photographs or read about it. The colours of the New York streets would have appeared to me in Trinidad as dead colours, the colours of dead things, dried grass, dead vegetation, earth, sand, a dead world, hardly colours at all. I went walking. In my memory there is only one walk, but I believe now that there would have been two, with a taxi ride in between, to check up on the sailing time for the ship that was to take me away that afternoon. Without the money in the suitcase I would have been penniless, so at least that precaution had served. I saw a cinema advertising Marius with Rému. The advertisement was in movable letters. I had never seen a French film in my life, but I knew much about French cinema. I had read about it, and I had even in some way studied it, in case a question came up in a French cultural general paper. So much of my education had been like that, abstract, a test of memory, like a man denied the chance of visiting famous cities, learning their street maps instead. So much of my education had been like that, monkish, medieval, learning quite separate from everyday things. Marius, Rému. One name was like an anagram of the other, bar the S, my monkish way of observing, studying, committing to memory. And if it had been afternoon, and if I didn't have a ship to take, I would have gone. For at home, that was where, imaginatively, I lived most profoundly, in the cinema. Really, over and above that quirk of literary ambition, there was a great simplicity to my character. I knew very little about the agricultural colony in the New World where I was born, and of my Asiatic Hindu community, a transplanted peasant community, I knew only my extended family. All my life, from the moment I had become self-aware, had been devoted to study. Study of the abstract sort I have tried to give some idea of. And then this idea of abstract study had been converted into an idea of a literary life in another country. That had committed me to further, more desperate, more consuming study, had committed me to further withdrawal. My real life, my literary life, was to be elsewhere. In the meantime, at home, I lived imaginatively in the cinema, a foretaste of that life abroad. On Saturday afternoons, after the special holiday shows which began at 1:30 and which we simply called 1:30, rather in the way other people might speak of matinees, it was painful after the dark cinema and the remote realms where one had been living for 3 hours or so to come out into the very bright colours of one's own world. But I had not seen any French films. They had never been shown in Trinidad, and perhaps, like British films, if they had been shown they would have found no audience, being of a particular country, local, not universal, like the Hollywood pictures, which could quicken the imaginations of remote people. I knew French films from books, especially Roger Manvel's Film. I knew all the still photographs in that book. His reverential text and the enthusiasm that had been given me at school for France as the country of civilization made me see extraordinary virtue in those strongly lighted, poorly reproduced small photographs. And now, less than a day into my great adventure, seeing the name Marius and its near anagram, Remus, on the cinema board, I felt I was close to something that was mine by right, by education, vocation, training, yearning, sacrifice, like the New York Times itself, which yet, when bought by me, didn't hold me, being like a crossword puzzle I could only partly fill in. And a similar feeling of being let down by what should have been mine by right came when I found and went into a bookshop. Great cities possessed bookshops, just as they had cinemas which showed French films. Colonial towns or settlements like my own didn't have bookshops. In the old colonial main square in Port of Spain, antique roofs and awnings of corrugated iron, once painted red or in alternate stripes of white and red, old carpentry, fretted gables with finials, decorative Victorian ironwork, architecture that spoke to me of our remoteness from the ports where that timber and decorative ironwork and corrugated iron were shipped. In the old colonial square there were emporia that sold schoolbooks and perhaps children's books and colouring books, and had perhaps as well a short shelf or two of Penguin books, a few copies of a few titles, and a few of the Collins classics, looking like Bibles. Emporia as dull as the emporia of those days could be, suggesting warehouses for colonial population were absolutely necessary goods, with a few specialist lines like mosquito nets and the Collins classics were imported and stored in as unattractive and practical a way as possible. And here, in the city of New York, was a bookshop, a place I should have entered as though I had journeyed to enter it. I loved books. I was a reader. It was my reputation at home, but the books I knew or knew about were few. There were the books in my father's bookcase, classics from the Everyman series, religious books, books about Hinduism and India. These last were bought from a trader in Indian goods in a petty commercial street in Port of Spain, and bought, most of them, as a gesture of Indian nationalism. Few of them were read by my father, and none by me. There were the books I had studied at school. There were the books I saw in the Central Library. Really, though, I knew only the classical or established names, the French, Spanish, and English books I had studied at school, and the very famous names my father had introduced me to. To enter this New York bookshop was to find myself among unhallowed names. I was travelling to be a writer, but this world of modern writing and publishing I had walked into was not something I was in touch with. And among all these unfamiliar, unhallowed names, I looked for the familiar, the classics, the uniform series, the very things I had looked at with a feeling of deprivation and being far away, in the dark colonial emporia of Port of Spain, among the reams of paper and the stacks of exercise books, next to wholesalers of various kinds of imported goods, cloth and coal pots, all in a warm smell of spices and damp raw sugar and various cooking oils from the wholesale grocers of South Quay, where there were donkey carts and horse carts and push carts among the motor trucks. This was an American shop, not one with English stock, the stock I was more familiar with. I settled then for the Modern Library series and bought South Wind. This had been recommended to me by an English teacher who knew of my writing ambitions. I had despaired of finding this book in the Emporia of Trinidad. Here, part of the great wealth of New York, was the book, immediately available. I paid 128, and the assistant, who must have been 8 or 10 years older than me, called me Sir. South Wind. But it remained unread. My first attempt to read it was like all the attempts I made later. It showed me that, like the books of Aldous Huxley and D.H. Lawrence and certain other contemporary writers whose names had come to me through my father or through teachers at school, this book, with a young man called Dennis and a bishop and an island called Nepenthe, was alien, far from anything in my experience, and beyond my comprehension. But the alienness of a book, though it might keep me from reading it, I never read beyond the first chapter of South Wind, did not prevent me from admiring it. The very alienness, the inaccessibility, was like a promise of romance, a reward, some way in the future, for making myself a writer. So much of my education had been abstract that I could live like this, and think and feel like this. I had, for instance, studied classical French drama without having any idea of the country or the court that had produced this drama, without having the capacity to grasp the historical reality of France, and in fact, quietly, in my own mind, rejecting as a fairy story all that I was told in introductions or textbooks about kings and ministers and mistresses and religious wars. These things were too removed from my experience, and I could not grasp them. I knew only my island and my community and the ways of our colony. I had prepared essays on French and Soviet cinema simply by reading books and articles. I had learnt the great names of art and architecture in the same way. So, though now in New York I was a free man, and this was the first book I was buying in a great city, and the occasion was therefore important, historical for me, romantic, I took to it the abstract attitudes of my school education. The bright boy, the scholarship boy, not acting now for his teachers or family, but acting only for himself. Yet, with the humiliations of my first 24 hours of travel, my first 24 hours in the great world, with my increasing sense of my solitude in this world, I was aware, not having a home audience now, not having any audience at all, that I felt no joy. The young man in the shop called me sir, and that was unexpected and nice. But I felt a fraud. I felt pushed down into a part of myself where I had never been. Less than 24 hours had passed since the magical vision of landscape, sugar-cane fields and forested hills and valleys, and the crawling sea, and the clouds lit from above by the sun. But already I could feel the two sides of myself separating one from the other, the man from the writer. Already I felt a twinge of doubt about myself. Perhaps the writer was only a man with an abstract education, a capacity for concentration, and a capacity for learning things by heart. And I had worked so hard for this day and this adventure. With a new silence of my solitude, this solitude something I had never anticipated as part of the great adventure, I watched the two sides of myself separate and dwindle, even on this first day. And that afternoon in New York, from a peer whose number I carried for many years in my head, but which I have now forgotten, a number not associated with romance but with humiliation and uncertainty, there began a journey on a ship of some days. Port of Spain, to Puerto Rico, to New York, by air. New York to Southampton, by ship. That journey by ship was for a long time, many weeks, many months, a long time to a boy of 18, my most precious piece of writer's material. Or so I saw it. And for a long time in a boarding house in Earl's Court in London, in the dreariness of my college room in Oxford, and in the greater dreariness of a bed-sitting room in the holidays, using my indelible pencil or my Waterman pen or the very old typewriter I had bought in London for £10, more than a week's allowance for me. Expensive, but new typewriters at that time, the war not being long over, were still not easily available, I wrote and cherished a piece I called Gala Night. It was my first piece of writing based on metropolitan material. It was wise. It suggested experience and the traveller. Gala Night. It might have been written by a man who had seen many gala nights. Knowing what it was doing, knowing the value of names, it played easily with great names. New York, the Atlantic, the SS Columbia, United States Lines, Southampton. Especially beautiful as a name, this last. The Gala Night that provided the material for this piece of descriptive writing, it was not a story, took place on shipboard on our last full day on the Atlantic. In the morning we were to call at Cove, in Ireland, then we were to dock at Southampton in the afternoon. Most of the passengers were to get off at Southampton, the others would get off the next morning at Le Havre. The Gala Night was a dance after dinner in one of the lounges of the tourist class, and it was disturbing to me to see, as from a distance, and as though I were studying a kind of animal life, since no shipboard romance had come to me, how the sexual impulse, like drink, clouded and distorted people I knew, men and women. To me, a lover of women, but quite virginal at that time, the distortion in the women I had got to know was especially unsettling. There was a dainty girl who had spoken to me of poetry. How strange to see her now in the company of a man of no particular education or quality, and to see her moist-eyed, as though worked upon by forces outside her control. There was no recognition of me now in her eyes. And how distant, earnest and preoccupied hitherto friendly men became, how impatient a conversation with me, conversation they had at other times welcomed. There was a man from San Francisco, an Armenian. He had fought in Europe during the war, and we had talked of the war and the soldier's life. He had told me that the only true war film he had seen was A Walk in the Sun. His thoughts were now elsewhere. Part of the trouble was that the gala night was also an occasion of drinking, and I at that time didn't drink at all. To win my scholarship, I had punished myself with study, and because I wished things to go well for me, I was full of ascetic self-castigations. In what I wrote, I was recording my ignorance and innocence, my deprivations, of which the asceticism was a disingenuous sign, and frustration. But gala night, in the intention of the 18-year-old boy who was doing the writing, was knowing and unillusioned, so that in the writing, as well as in the man, there was a fracture. To a truly knowing person, the piece would have given itself away in more than one place. I concentrated towards the end of the piece on the figure of the ship's night watchman. He was standing outside the lounge where the dancing was taking place, and he had begun to address the disconsolate and unlucky men standing outside with him, men to whom, even on this wanton occasion, when dainty girls went dreamy and wild, no shipboard romance had come. He was as divided as I was, and perhaps the other men who were listening to him. There was a sourness in their silence. He, the night watchman, was lively. He spoke as a man who had seen it all. He was a heavily built man in his 40s. In the lecturing posture he had settled into, his hands, stretched out on either side of him, grasped the handrail against which he was leaning. He paused between sentences to allow the wickedness he was describing to sink in. Looking at no one in particular, he pressed his lips together, and then, as if talking to himself, he started again. "People changed after 3 days on a ship," he said. "Faithful wives and girlfriends became faithless. Always. After 3 days. Men became violent and were ready to fight over women, even men with young and loving wives to whom they had just said goodbye. He said, or in many versions of Gala Night I made him say, 'I have seen a captain make to kill a guy in this here place.'" Make to, kill, guy, this here place. In addition to what he was saying, his lack of illusion about men and women, comforting in one way, that lack of illusion, and the fierce judgment it implied, but also very painful, this account of a near universal wantonness that was nevertheless denied us, the night watchman talked like someone in a film. And that was why, as material, he was so precious to me. That was why the hard, indelible pencil traced again and again in those faint letters, which would brighten and turn purple when dampened, the words he spoke. In Gala Night, I looked for metropolitan material. I stuck to people who seemed to me to have this quality. There was a man, originally from the Middle East, but now, in spite of his Muslim name, entirely American, who said he was an entertainer. He spoke familiarly of famous stars, stars whose films I had seen, and it never occurred to me to wonder why this entertainer was travelling tourist. He read me some of his material. After the usual 3 days. Material, that was what he called it, and the short and simple jokes were typed. That was impressive and strange and American to me, that such trivial material should be typed, should be given that formality. As impressive as that was his way of talking of his time in animated cartoons. "They made many cartoons at the same time," he said. "We make them and we can them." Can. I was entranced by the word, so knowing, so casual, so professional. Just as his material became part of mine, so his language became part of my material as well. So that I was having it both ways with him, making use as a writer of his metropolitan knowingness, appropriating it, yet keeping myself at a distance from him. Not on the ship, only in Gala Night, as though he, being only an entertainer, travelling tourist, and dubiously American, was a kind of buffoon, the kind of buffoon such a person should be in writing of the sort I was aiming at, and as though I, now adrift, supported only by the abstractions of my colonial education, stood on firmer ground than he. Two Salvation Army girls were also among my material. They were travelling to a conference somewhere in Europe, but they were ready to flirt. This flirtatiousness in religious girls struck me as strange. With my deprivations, I saw oddity where there was none. And there was a young man from the south. He shared the entertainer's cabin. He was heavy and pockmarked, and he wore glasses. In gala night, he appeared, and the scene was written so often by me that in my imagination he remains forever, in undershirt and underpants, sitting on the upper bunk, in the dim top light, peeling and eating an orange, and talking about girls, perhaps the Salvation Army girls. He said, looking down at his orange, "I'm a plodder. I know what I want, and I go get it, see?" That was material for me. I could show the world, writing like that, observing things like that, that I knew the world. I could say, in effect, "I, too, have seen this, and I, too, can write about it." But there was another memory, disconnected from the first. In some versions of Gala Night, I used it. In other versions, I left it out. The young southerner was talking about coloured people. He said, "Nowadays they want to get in your bed and sleep with you." I was taken aback by that, and then amazed that he, so full of racial feeling, could talk to me like that as though he didn't see me racially. But that topic of race, though it was good, familiar material, and could prove my knowledge of the world, formed no part of Gala Night. It was too close to my disturbance, my vulnerability, the separation of my two selves. That was not the kind of personality the writer wished to assume. That was not the material he dealt in. So that, though travelling to write, concentrating on my experience, eager for experience, I was shutting myself off from it, editing it out of my memory. Editing out the airport taxi driver who had overcharged me. The humiliation had been too great. Editing out the Negro at the hotel. Nor, as a writer, could I acknowledge the other hideous anxiety of my day in New York. The journey in a liner across the Atlantic should have been pure romance. The going aboard the ship that afternoon in New York should have been pure romance. But romance was in only one part of my mind. There was something else in another part of my mind. I was nervous about sharing a cabin. For months I had worried about that aspect of my journey across the Atlantic. I feared being put with aggressive or disagreeable or sexually unbalanced people. I was small and felt my physical weakness. I feared being assaulted. I feared attracting someone's malevolence. That had been a great anxiety for me. But when I went aboard the ship, it had been miraculously resolved. Yet I could not, in Gala Night, wishing to be the kind of writer I wanted to be, write about that. The British Vice Consul in New York had booked a passage for someone who, when he went aboard the ship at the pier in New York, was clearly seen not to be English, and was a puzzle to the purser. I remember it only now, so successful was Gala Night in cutting out the memory. Only now, laying aside the material of Gala Night, I remember having to stand about for some hours while they decided where to put me. I would have been unplaced, would have been standing about, worried about my few pieces of luggage, even while the ship was leaving the pier. My sight of the New York Harbour and the famous skyline would have been tainted by that standing about. And then someone took a decision. And the issue was wonderfully resolved. I was given a cabin absolutely to myself, in a higher class. And I was given a key to open the door that separated that class from the tourist class, where I was to continue to live and eat during the day. This was a wonderful piece of luck. Immediately, much of my anxiety left me. I thought it a very good omen for the future. I thought, still with the fear of sharing cabins, compartments, and hotel bathrooms, that I would be blessed with what I thought of then as traveller's luck. But that night, when I was asleep, there was a commotion that awakened me. The top light of the cabin was put on. There were voices. I knew then, I knew what was about to happen. Someone was going to be put with me. Someone else from tourist was going to be given a key to the door, which for some hours that evening I had thought of as a very private possession, almost a secret, that separated the classes. And the top light, put on just like that, and the raised voices were so inconsiderate. I closed my eyes, like a child, like someone practicing magic. If I pretended to be asleep, if I pretended to know nothing, then nothing might happen, and the people who had come in might all just go away. But there was trouble. The man who had been brought in was making trouble. He was rejecting the cabin. His voice was rising. He said, "It's because I'm coloured you're putting me here with him." Coloured. So he was a Negro. So this was a little ghetto privilege I had been given. But I didn't want the Negro or anybody else to be with me. Especially I didn't want the Negro to be with me for the very reasons the Negro had given. And he wasn't to be with me. The top light went out. The cabin door closed. The people who had come in went out. And the Negro was no doubt taken back, past the barrier door to tourist class, and fitted into some crowded 3- or 4-berth cabin, but with white people. Satisfactory to him, the black man. But at what price, at what cost in strain and tension for the days of the journey across the great Atlantic? Frightening, that glimpse of another man's deprivation and drive. Yet I was also ashamed that they had brought the Negro to my cabin. I was ashamed that, with all my aspirations, and all that I had put into this adventure, this was all that people saw in me, so far from the way I thought of myself, so far from what I wanted for myself. And it was shame, too, that made me keep my eyes closed while they were in the cabin. He, the black man, sought me out the next morning in the lounge of the tourist class to apologize. He was tall, slender, well-dressed, with a suggestion of boniness and sharpness below his fine, thin summer suiting. Bony knees, sharp shins. He was well-spoken, quieter with me than he had been in the cabin. He had thought that the people from the purser's office were genuinely offering him a better and less crowded cabin when they led him beyond the tourist door. But when he saw me, he changed his mind. He knew that I had become the nucleus of a little ghetto. He knew the Americans, he said. What else did he tell me? What else was there to him, apart from his racial passion? Was he so restricted? I remember nothing else. I remember no other meeting with him. A woman, young but older than my 18, told me more about him one day on deck. He clearly had made an impression on some of the passengers. He was fatigued by American prejudice, the woman said, and she spoke of him with understanding and also a kind of admiration. He was going to live in Germany, she said. His wife was German. They had met when he was serving with the army in Germany. He had grown to like the German people. Strange pilgrimage. In Puerto Rico there had been the Trinidad Negro in a tight jacket on his way to Harlem. Here was a man from Harlem, or Black America, on his way to Germany. In each there were aspects of myself. But with my Asiatic background I resisted the comparison, and I was travelling to be a writer. It was too frightening to accept the other thing, to face the other thing. It was to be diminished as man and writer. Racial diminution formed no part of the material of the kind of writer I was setting out to be. Thinking of myself as a writer, I was hiding my experience from myself, hiding myself from my experience. And even when I became a writer, I was without the means, for many years, to cope with that disturbance. I wrote on with my indelible pencil. I noted dialogue. My I was aloof, a man who took notes and knew. Night and day a man stood in the bow of the ship, scanning the grey sea ahead, and when finally I landed at Southampton I had for a short while the pleasing sensation that the ground moved below my feet, the way the ship had moved for 5 days. I had arrived in England. I had made the journey by ship. The passenger terminal was new. Southampton, of the pretty name, had been much bombed during the war. The new terminal looked to the future, but passenger liners were soon to be things of the past. After the grey of the Atlantic, there was colour. Bright colour seen from the train that went to London. Late afternoon light. An extended dusk. New, enchanting to someone used to the more or less equal division of day and night in the tropics. Light, dusk, at an hour which would have been night at home. But it was night when we arrived at Waterloo Station. I liked the size, the many platforms, the big, high roof. I liked the lights. used at home to public places or those I knew, schools, stores, offices, working only in natural light, I liked this excitement of a railway station busy at night and brightly lit up. I saw the station people working in electric light, and the travellers as dramatic figures. The station lights gave a suggestion, such as the New York streets had already given me, of a canopied world, a vast home interior. After 5 days on the liner, I wanted to go out. I wanted especially to go to a cinema. I had heard that in London the cinemas ran continuously. At home I was used to shows at fixed times. The idea of the continuous show as the metropolitan way of doing things, with all that it implied of a great, busy populace, was very attractive. But even for London, even for the metropolitan populace of London, it was too late. I went directly to the boarding house in Earl's Court, where a room had been reserved for me for the 2 months or so before I went to Oxford. It was a small room, long and narrow, made dark by dark, bulky furniture, and bare otherwise, with nothing on the walls. As bare as my cabin on the Columbia. Barer than the room I had had in the Hotel Wellington for that night in New York. My heart contracted. But there was one part of me that rejoiced at the view from the window, some floors up, of the bright orange street lights and the effects of the lights on the trees. After the warm, rubbery smell of the ship, the smell of the air conditioning in enclosed cabins and corridors, there were new smells in the morning. A cloying smell of milk. Fresh milk was rare to me. We used Klim powdered milk and condensed milk. That thick, sweet smell of milk was mixed with the smell of soot, and that smell was overlaid with the airless, cockroachy smell of old dirt. Those were the morning smells. The garden, or yard, or plot of ground at the back of the house ran to a high wall. Behind that high wall was the underground railway station. Romance! The sound of trains there all the time, and from very early in the morning. Speaking directly to me now of what the Negro in the New York hotel had spoken, the city that never slept. The bathrooms and lavatories were at the end of the landing on each floor, or perhaps on every other floor, because as I was going down there came up a young man of Asia, small and small-boned, with a pale yellow complexion, with glasses, and an elaborate Asiatic dressing gown that was too big for him in the arms. The wide embroidered cuffs hid his hands. He gave out a tinkling, "Good morning," and hurried past me. Was he Siamese, Burmese, Chinese? He looked forlorn, far from home. As yet, still full of my London wonder, my own success in having arrived in the city, I did not make the same judgment about myself. I was going down to the dining room, in the basement. The boarding house offered bed and breakfast, and I was going down to the breakfast. The dining room at the front of the house, sheltered from the noise of the underground trains, subject only to the vibration, had two or three people. It had many straight-backed brown chairs. The walls were as blank as the walls of my room. The milk and soot smell was strong here. It was morning, light outside, but a weak electric bulb was on. The wall was yellowish, shiny. Wall, light, smell. They were all parts of the wonderful London morning, as was my sight of the steep, narrow steps going up to the street, the rails, the pavement. I had never been in a basement before. It was not a style of building we had at home, but I had read of basements in books, and this room, with an electric light burning on a bright, sunny day, seemed to me romantic. I was like a man entering the world of a novel, a book, entering the real world. I went and looked around the upper floor afterwards, or that part of it that was open to guests. The front room was full of chairs, straight-backed chairs, and fat, low, upholstered chairs, and the walls were as bare as the walls everywhere else. This was the lounge. I had been told that downstairs. But the air was so still, such a sooty old smell came off the dark carpet and the tall old curtains, that I felt the room wasn't used. I felt the house was no longer being used as the builder or first owner had intended. I felt that at one time, perhaps before the war, it had been a private house, and, though knowing nothing about London houses, I felt it had come down in the world. Such was my tenderness towards London, or my idea of London. And I felt, as I saw more and more of my fellow lodgers, Europeans from the continent and North Africa, Asiatics, some English people from the provinces, simple people in cheap lodgings, that we were all, in a way, campers in the big house. And coming back, night after night, after my tourist excursions through London, to this bare house, I was infected by its mood. I took this mood to what I saw. I had no eye for architecture. There had been nothing at home to train my eye. In London I saw pavements, shops, shop blinds, almost every other one stenciled at the bottom, J. Dean, Maker, Putney, shop signs, undifferentiated buildings. On my tourist excursions I went looking for size. It was one of the things I had travelled to find, coming from my small island. I found size, power, in the area around Holborn Viaduct, the embankment, Trafalgar Square, and after this grandeur, there was a boarding house in Earl's Court. So I grew to feel that the grandeur belonged to the past, that I had come to England at the wrong time, that I had come too late to find the England, the heart of empire, which, like a provincial from a far corner of the empire, I had created in my fantasy. Such a big judgment about a city I had just arrived in. But that way of feeling was something I carried within myself. The older people in our Asian Indian community in Trinidad, especially the poor ones who could never manage English or get used to the strange races, looked back to an India that became more and more golden in their memory. They were living in Trinidad and were going to die there, but for them it was the wrong place. Something of that feeling was passed down to me. I didn't look back to India, couldn't do so. My ambition caused me to look ahead and outwards, to England. But it led to a similar feeling of wrongness. In Trinidad, feeling myself far away, I had held myself back, as it were, for life at the centre of things, and there were aspects of the physical setting of my childhood which positively encouraged that mood of waiting and withdrawal. We lived in Trinidad, among advertisements for things that were no longer made, or, because of the war and the difficulties of transport, had ceased to be available. The advertisements in American magazines for Chris Craft and Statler Hotels and things like that belonged to another impossibly remote world. Many of the advertisements in Trinidad were for old-fashioned remedies and tonics. They were on tin, these advertisements, and enameled. They were used as decorations in shops, and having no relation to the goods offered for sale, they grew to be regarded as emblems of the shopkeeper's trade. Later, during the war, when the shanty settlement began to grow in the swampland to the east of Port of Spain, these enameled tin advertisements were used sometimes as building material. So I was used to living in a world where the signs were without meaning, or without the meaning intended by their makers. It was of a piece with the abstract, arbitrary nature of my education, like my ability to study French or Russian cinema without seeing a film, an ability which was, as I have said, like a man trying to get to know a city from its street map alone. What was true of Trinidad seemed to be true of other places as well. In the book sections of some of the colonial emporia of Port of Spain, there would be a shelf or two of the cheap wartime Penguin paperbacks, narrow margins, crudely stapled, with the staples rusting quickly in our damp climate, but with a wonderful colour, texture and smell to the paper. It never struck me as odd that at the back of those wartime Penguins there should sometimes be advertisements for certain British things, chocolates, shoes, shaving cream, that had never been available in Trinidad and were now, because of the war, as the advertisements said, no longer being made. Such advertisements being put in by the former manufacturers only to keep their brand names alive during the war, and in the hope that the war would turn out well. These advertisements, for things doubly and trebly removed from possibility, never struck me as odd. They came to me as an aspect of the romance of the world I was working towards, a promise within the promise, and intensely romantic. So I was ready to imagine that the world in which I found myself in London was something less than the perfect world I had striven towards. As a child in Trinidad, I'd put this world at a far distance, in London, perhaps. In London now I was able to put this perfect world at another time, an earlier time. The mental or emotional processes were the same. In the underground stations there were still old-fashioned, heavy vending machines with raised metal letters. No sweets, no chocolates came from them now. But for 10 years or so no one had bothered to take them away. They were like things in a house that had broken down or been superseded, but remained unthrown away. 2 doors away from my boarding house in Earl's Court, there was a bomb site, a gap in the road, with neat rubble where the basement should have been, the dining room of a house like the one in which I lived. Such sites were all over the city. I saw them in the beginning. Then I stopped seeing them. Paternoster Row, at the side of St. Paul's Cathedral, hardly existed, but the name still appeared on the title page of books as the London address of many publishers. My tramps about London were ignorant and joyless. I had expected the great city to leap out at me and possess me. I had longed so much to be in it, and soon, within a week or less, I was very lonely. If I had been less lonely, if I'd had the equivalent of my shipboard life, I might have felt differently about London and the boarding house, but I was solitary and didn't have the means of finding the kind of society I'd had for the 5 days of the Atlantic crossing. There was the British Council. They ran a meeting place for foreign students like me, but there, one evening, the first time I went, I found myself in conversation with a bored girl, turning to the subject of physical pain, a fearful obsession of mine, made more fearful with the war, and one further explanation of the austerities I practiced at various times. I began to talk of torture, and persevered, though knowing it to be wrong to do so, and was so alarmed by this further distortion of myself, more distorted than my behaviour during the flight to New York, first with the negro in Puerto Rico, then with the English woman in the seat beside me, that I never went to that British Council place again, for shame. I had only the boarding house, and that curious, mixed, silent company of English people, Europeans in limbo, and a few Asiatic students, to whom English was difficult. And perhaps that boarding house life might have meant more to me if I were better read in contemporary English books, if, for example, I had read Hangover Square, which was set in the very area just 11 years or so before. A book like that would have peopled the area and made it romantic, and given me, always needing these proofs from books, some sharper sense of myself. But in spite of my education, I was underread. What did I know of London? There was an essay by Charles Lamb, in a schoolbook about going to the theatre. There were 2 or 3 lovely sentences, in another schoolbook, about the embankment from Lord Arthur Savile's crime. But Sherlock Holmes's Baker Street was just its name, and the London references in Somerset Maugham and War, and others, didn't create pictures in the mind because they assumed too much knowledge in the reader. The London I knew, or imaginatively possessed, was the London I had got from Dickens. It was Dickens and his illustrators who gave me the illusion of knowing the city. I was therefore, without knowing it, like the Russians I was to hear about and marvel at, who still believed in the reality of Dickens's London. Years later, looking at Dickens during a time when I was writing hard myself, I felt I understood a little more about Dickens's unique power as a describer of London, and his difference from all other writers about London. I felt that when, as a child far away, I read the early Dickens and was able with him to enter the dark city of London, it was partly because I was taking my own simplicity to his, fitting my own fantasies to his. The city of 130 years before must have been almost as strange to him as it was to me, and it was his genius to describe it when he was an adult, as a child might have described it, not displaying architectural knowledge or taste, not using technical words, using only simple words like old-fashioned to describe whole streets, using no words that might disturb or unsettle an unskilled or unknowledgeable reader, using no words to unsettle a child far away, in the tropics, where the roofs were of corrugated iron and the gables were done in fretwork, and there were jalousied windows hinged at the top to keep out the rain while letting in light and air. Using Dickens, only simple words, simple concepts, to create simple volumes and surfaces and lights and shadows, creating thereby a city or fantasy which everyone could reconstruct out of his own materials, using the things he knew to recreate the described things he didn't know. To Dickens, this enriching of one's own surroundings by fantasy was one of the good things about fiction, and it was apt that Dickens's childlike vision should have given me, with my own child's ideas, my abstract education, and my very simple idea of my vocation, an illusion of complete knowledge of the city where I expected this vocation to flower. Leaving Rome at the same time, fantasies being what they are, for other late 19th-century ideas of size and imperial grandeur, which neither Buckingham Palace, nor Westminster, nor Whitehall gave me, but which I got from Paddington and Waterloo stations, and from Holborn Viaduct and the Embankment, great Victorian engineering works. I had come to London as to a place I knew very well. I found a city that was strange and unknown, in its style of houses and even in the names of its districts, as strange as my boarding house, which was quite unexpected, a city as strange and unread about as the Englishness of South Wind, which I'd bought in New York for the sake of its culture. The disturbance in me, faced with this strangeness, was very great, many times more diminishing than the disturbance I'd felt in New York when I had entered, as though entering something that was mine by right, the bookshop which had turned out to have very little for me after all. And something else occurred in those very early days, the first days of arrival. I lost a faculty that had been part of me and precious to me for years. I lost the gift of fantasy, the dream of the future, the far-off place where I was going. At home I had lived most intensely in the cinema, where, before the fixed-hour shows, the cinema boys, to shut out daylight or electric street-light, closed the double doors all around and untied the long cords that kept the high wooden windows open. In those dark halls I had dreamt of a life elsewhere. Now, in the place that for all those years had been the elsewhere, no further dream was possible. And while on my very first night in London I had wanted to go to the cinema for the sake of those continuous shows I had heard about, to me the very essence of metropolitan busyness, very soon now the idea of the cinema, the idea of entering a dark hall to watch a moving film, became oppressive to me. I had thought of the cinema pleasure as a foretaste of my adult life. Now, with all kinds of shame in many recesses of my mind, I felt it to be fantasy. I hadn't read Hangover Square, didn't even know of it as a book, but I had seen the film. Its Hollywood London had merged in my mind, perhaps because of the associations of the titles, into the London of The Lodger. Now I knew that London to be fantasy, worthless to me, and the cinema pleasure that had gone so deep into me and had in the barren years of abstract study given me such support, that cinema pleasure was now cut away as with a knife. And when, 10 or 12 years later, I did return to the cinema, the Hollywood I had known was dead, the extraordinary circumstances in which it had flourished no longer existing. American films had become as self-regardingly local as the French or English, and there was as much distance between a film and me as between a book or a painting and me. Fantasy was no longer possible. I went to the cinema not as a dreamer or a fantast, but as a critic. I had little to record. My trampings about London didn't produce adventures, didn't sharpen my eye for buildings or people. My life was restricted to the Earl's Court boarding house. There was a special kind of life there. But I failed to see it, because, ironically, though feeling myself already drying up, I continued to think of myself as a writer, and as a writer was still looking for suitable metropolitan material. Metropolitan. What did I mean by that? I had only a vague idea. I meant material which would enable me to compete with or match certain writers, and I also meant material that would enable me to display a particular kind of writing personality. J.R. Ackerley of Hindu Holiday, perhaps, making notes under a dinner table in India. Somerset Maugham, aloof, everywhere, unsurprised, immensely knowing. Aldous Huxley, so full of all kinds of knowledge, and also so sexually knowing. Evelyn Waugh, so elegant, so naturally. Wishing to be that kind of writer, I didn't see material in the campers in the Big Earl's Court house. One Sunday, not long after I had come to London, I was invited to lunch by the Hardings. Mr. Harding was the manager of the boarding house, but I had seen almost nothing of him or his wife. I had seen more of Angela, whose last name I seldom used and in the end forgot. Angela was Italian, from the south of the country. She was in her mid or late 20s, but I couldn't really tell. She was older than me, 10 years at least, and I saw her as very mature. She had spent all the war in Italy and had somehow fetched up, like many of her friends, in London. Angela had a room in the house and some kind of position, but I wasn't sure what the position was. She sometimes was in the dining room in the basement, serving the breakfasts, and sometimes she was there in the evening.